Accession number 9331, Reel 1.
Mr. Jepson, Reel 1. Where were you born, Mr. Jepson?
In London, in the temple. And I don't mean the religious temple, I mean the barrister's temple.
Which year was that?
That year would be 1900, something like that. Perhaps.
How did your family earn its living?
I beg your pardon?
How did your family earn its living?
How did it come to be there?
No, your father, what did your father do?
He was a writer and a barrister-writer.
Where were you educated?
St. Paul's. And the Sorbonne.
What did you read at the Sorbonne?
French literature, French history, and had a good time.
When did you take up employment?
When did I take up employment? I went to the Amalgamated Press as an office boy in about 1927.
Did you enjoy it?
I enjoyed the Yes, I think I did, on the whole. There were a lot of nice people, and then I became the editor of the London Magazine and commissioned short stories for it, including long articles about dreadnoughts written by Churchill. And then I discovered I could write short stories. So I wrote a short story and sold it down the passage to another magazine and went to Italy.
To do what?
To live and write and generally enjoy myself. And I lived on Capri for 2 years, something like that. Then I moved, I got married, and we moved to Alassio in Liguria, and I was there another 2 years.
Coming on to the outbreak of war, did it take you by surprise?
Oh, no. I wrote a play with Leslie Storm called Dark Horizon, which is the last play on at Daly's Theatre before it was closed, in which we predicted the coming of the war, and that was in 1933.
Because of the coming to power of Hitler?
Well, the obvious historic pattern that was emerging, the character of the German people, who always like a dictator for a leader, and everything followed inevitably and historically from that point.
So what was your reaction when you heard Chamberlain make his...
Perhaps unwisely, I don't know, I put my name down on a thing called the Officers Emergency Reserve. And I sat there for all through the so-called phony war, which was really devoted to our building up such armaments as we could. And was then posted to the Buffs, the third afoot, as a lieutenant. And I was there in the battalion. I became the adjutant of the battalion, which gave me an insight into how the army worked and how one could work it And I then went to MI1X, which was the recruiting of officers for intelligence duties in the army. And from there I went on being asked for somebody by Special Operations Executive, for somebody with a knowledge of French and Italian languages. And I looked at all my files and the files of the department, and I couldn't find anybody until I found my own name. So I suggested myself to Special Operations Executive and went there.
How were you recruited originally to MI1X?
By being amiable and friendly with the Commandant of the Intelligence Corps, who came to Northern Ireland, where I was then posted, with the Northern Ireland troops. And I took him round all the different units and introduced him to commanding officers and things like that, because I was fairly senior, and got on very well with him. And he then recruited me to MI1X, which was one of his departments at the War Office.
Did you know anything about it before you went in?
About what, recruiting?
MI1X.
Only that while I was there, while I was in Northern Ireland, looking for officers for intelligence work, I looked for intelligence officers who could work in SOE's various departments and activities. And that's, so I, in other words, I recruited myself.
Can you recollect the date that you actually entered SOE?
Late 1942. Or was it January 43? Somewhere about Christmas time. Just about the time that SOE was becoming effective. And I went to the French section, where I went on recruiting. And I was then now recruiting people who could work in the resistance, and with particular reference to sabotage.
So you were actually called a recruiting officer in SOE, were you?
I was, yes. I was the recruiting officer, French section of SOE. And that didn't mean I didn't recruit for other sections who weren't anything like as big or as had so many people on the ground. And I was responsible for recruiting women for the work in the face of a good deal of opposition from the powers that be, who said that women under the Geneva Convention were not allowed to take combatant duties, which they regarded as resistance work in France as being. It took me some time to find a proper answer to that, and then I found it. I discovered that the anti-aircraft units always had ATS officers on their strength, and that when it came to firing an anti-aircraft gun, the person who pulled the lanyard that released the trigger was a woman, an ATS officer. I think probably the quality of this recording is bad. I've got a bit of a frog in my throat, so I'm going to cough. I've coughed.
That's fine.
And it's a little bit better, and I'll try and put my voice at the back of my throat, in which case it'll record not quite on such a high pitch. I ruined my voice in the First War in the OTC at St. Paul's by having to drill a company of guardsmen for practice when my voice was breaking. It hasn't been the same since.
Your voice is perfectly all right, so there's
well,
no need to alter.
Well, I always think it sounds either too high or squeaky or unintelligible.
No, it's very
but
clear.
But if it is clear, that is fine by me.
So, did you have any support in SOE for the position you took up for recruiting women? Or was
no,
everybody
I had,
against
I had
you?
A, quite, a completely free hand. No, I was in charge. I made a small department of my own for it, with assistants, a secretary and an assistant officer and things like that.
But was everybody...
Was support... Was everybody what?
Was everybody against you when you suggested women?
Well, yes. The one person who was not against it was the woman known as the Queen Bee, who was the chief of the Fannies. And I was, with her connivance, I dressed my women recruits in Fanny uniforms, which was very pretty and very nice, and gave them complete cover, because they could always be drivers or whatever it might be, or most of the army drivers of the higher echelons of the war, of the war effort, were Fannies.
Did you find that women were able to perform the role
much better than men?
Why was that?
Well, because women, as you must know, women have a greater capacity for cool and lonely courage than men, who usually want a mate with them. Men don't work alone. Their lives tend to be always in company with other men. Women are mostly on their own. It's a perfectly logical thing. And there was a good deal of opposition from various quarters until it went up to Churchill, who remembered me from the old days of the London Magazine, and he growled at me, "What are you doing?" I told him what I was doing. He said, "You're using women in this." And I said, "Yes, don't you think that probably the very sensible thing to do?" And he said, "Yes, good luck to you." And that was my authority. So any arguments, I said, "Well, would you mind talking to Mr. Churchill about it?"
Did you win over the opposition over the question of
women? I won it over by simply taking no notice of it. I didn't have to win it over, because I had the authority from the War Office to go ahead with whatever I was doing. I really was in an extraordinary position for somebody of my army rank, which was at that time of captain.
But those people who had opposed women, were they convinced in the end that they were such
Of course they did. I mean, I recruited Odette, for instance, who got a George Cross, and that was the end of that opposition.
Can you tell me specifically how you recruited Odette?
Mostly when I was recruiting civilians, or indeed people out of the services, and I recruited from all three services, I would write a letter on a room number in the War Office, saying just simply, "Dear Miss So-and-so, or dear Mrs. So-and-so, I understand that you have qualifications that may be of value in the war effort. Would you care to get in touch with me, and we might then discuss it further?" I would then interview them. They'd come to the War Office by appointment, and I would decide whether I would want to go on with them. I simply went on with the fiction that, or rather the cover, that they might have having languages and a knowledge of France and so forth, they might be of value in the war effort. And then they would go away when there was a sort of mutual decision, yes, they'd like to go on with it. I would then have to refer them their names and addresses to MI5 for vetting. But MI5 tend to be rather dilatory until I made a bit of a fuss, and then I got quick answers from MI5 as to nothing known, generally, simply nothing known against. Not a very positive vetting, but enough for me. And anyhow, by the time I'd interviewed them, I'd got a pretty good idea where their loyalties lay. And for the most part, they just hated Germany, hated the Germans, and wanted to get into the war. There really was no problem about their loyalties. Odette was a shrewd cookie, and she knew at once what it was about. She guessed and said yes, she wanted to do it. And I said, in effect, wait a minute, what are your domestic circumstances? And she said, oh, they wouldn't bother her. She had a husband and a couple of children, but the husband didn't come into the matter very much, and the children would be looked after by an aunt. And when could she start? And so I was rather doubtful about it. I don't know whether we ought to publish this. So it's all right. It's not coming out for years anyhow. I was rather doubtful about her capacity, although she had perfect French and knew France. Her personality was so big that I couldn't quite see her getting away with however good a cover story we gave her. I couldn't see her passing unnoticed. But in fact, I can remember that I wrote on, I had a sort of little form that I wrote names and addresses on, and for my own guidance made a comment at the bottom on the question of suitability. And I remember very clearly on her piece of paper I wrote, God help the Germans if we can ever get her near them, but maybe God help us on the way, because she has such a huge personality and will dominate everybody she comes in contact with. Not because she's necessarily of a dominant nature, but she just can't help it. She went to training, was very satisfactory. All the women were very satisfactory because they trained with the men. I had mixed classes, as I call them, and they went round the schools for their training. They trained with the men in classes that I would make up as I went along, generally one class once every 4 or 5 weeks, generally consisting of about 12 to 15 students, as we call them. What was noticeable was that the women were so much better than the men in all the kind of skills that the work would ask for. They took up, funnily enough, they took up pistol shooting with great avidity. Whether this, I don't know what psychological drive there was there, but there wasn't one of them who wasn't keen on it. Even when the pistol, which would be a 4-5 automatic, the recoil would sometimes be so shattering that they'd fall on their backs from the recoil, and then they'd get up and fire again and fall on their backs. It was that sort of determination that was so impressive.
So weren't the men superior in any respect?
Oh, well, they were different. They were not superior. It was only that women, when it came to moving about in France without being noticed, were in a sense better the work, because they could work alone, being basically lonely people, or on their own anyhow, that men are less lonely if they can possibly help it. It's just a difference of... it's not a question of superiority or inferiority, it's just a difference.
How had you heard about Odette in the first place?
I think I got her name from Central Registry, which also was looking for people for me, not knowing for what purpose, but were looking for people with good French for war work. And I think she came to me from Central Registry, as far as I can remember, not from one of the other services or from the people I had in the services or the AG branch in the War Office, the Adjutant General's branch, which would have the names of French speakers.
What was Central Registry?
Well, it was... Central Register was a register which I think hung out at... I think it was... I believe it worked in the Stoll Picture Theatre. It worked somewhere in Kingsway. Maybe it was Bush House. But it was it was simply a government organisation which had recorded and had the names of all kinds of civilians who put their names down or were discovered who might be have qualifications for all kinds of work in the war.
Were most of your contacts from Central Registry or from other
sources? No, most of my contacts came from different people I had out and about, people I knew who didn't necessarily know exactly what work I was doing, but who were asked to watch out for men and women in civilian life who had a knowledge of French, that's all. And that meant I got quite a number of names. MRD Foote says that I recruited something like 400 agents, men and women, something like 400, and from that meant I must have, if I rejected one in four, I must have seen a great number of people. I had a room in the War Office which had a washer hand basin in it, almost had a toilet in it, and the Hotel Victoria, which was annexed by the War Office for a greater number of people who wanted, had to have offices connected with the War Office.
The people who were looking out for you for suitable material, were these people who were looking out for you actually employed by SOE?
No. Well, SOE, yes. People in SOE at the other sections who knew that everybody was looking for linguists and people with knowledge of foreign countries would naturally steer any French potential to me. So SOE itself was a good fund, a good reservoir of recruits, potential recruits. But even so, they perhaps, SOE and its ramifications perhaps supplied a third of the people I interviewed.
Could you give the names of any particular people who were especially useful to you in feeding you with suitable names?
No, not with any certainty.
You talked about the MI5 vetting people.
Yes.
Did the MI5 often rule people out on security grounds?
I dare say. But not often. Not often. I mean, you see, the MI5's knowledge of people would be, in a sense, limited to their by their police contacts and people like that. You see, nothing known against really, I think, meant in effect nothing criminal known against them. They weren't on any police file. And I never bothered to find out how MI5 worked, but I imagine since they hadn't got any great resources of their own, they would use the existing sources such as the police.
What method of contact with MI5 did you have?
I used to ring them up. Who I rang up, I don't know, but I had a number to which I referred this. And I went on interviewing people at Hotel Victoria, in this ex-bedroom, until it got, the Germans apparently got to know too much about it. So the security people at SOE suggested I should change my name and have a better cover in some other location. Had I any ideas? And I said, well, I thought for a moment. Let's have an unlikely name like Ebenezer Potter, for instance, which happened to be in the name of a character in a short story I'd written at one time. And I said, I think I would like a room at the Ministry of Pensions. Ebenezer Potter, Captain Ebenezer Potter retired, in the Ministry of Pensions. Where else would you find him? So they then gave me a room, in a rather grand room, in the Ministry of Pensions. And there I continued to interview people. And even after the questions, there was one girl who knew about the work, guessed that I was involved in it, and came right out and told me that she knew what I was doing, and she wanted to do it too. And I thought, this won't do at all. The security, what about the security? The Germans may or may not know what I'm doing and who I am and this, that, and other, but we don't want anybody who might fall into their hands who would know too much about Ebenezer Potter. As it was, she went away, and her father was an eminent portrait painter with connections in political circles. And the next thing I knew, there was a question in the House of Commons about who was this Captain Ebenezer Potter who was doing strange things in the Ministry of Pensions.